Welcome to our first live Q&A session of the day. Dr. Beth Erickson from the Medical College of Wisconsin will now moderate the questions that came in for Drs. Chang and Palta.
Hi, I just need to get back to where I had the questions. Just one moment. Welcome, everybody. And we have a number of good questions, hoping everybody can hear me, for both of our excellent speakers. Let me just look here. Can you, this is for Dr. Palta, can you comment on long-term toxicity of short course versus long course rectal cancer treatment?
So, I think that's it's a great question. So there are a couple of randomized trials that have looked specifically at short course radiation compared to long course chemo radiation. The issue that many people have with those studies is that the data and the follow-up is not quite as mature as maybe we would like. So with shorter term data, 5 years in particular, in some of the trials that I mentioned in the slides, it does appear that the acute toxicity profile seems to be in favor of the short course treatment. In terms of long-term toxicity, I think that still remains to be seen. So we have 5-year data, we don't yet have data out to 10 years, et cetera. And some of the toxicity that we have seen with preoperative radiotherapy, for example, in the Dutch trial, in the Swedish rectal cancer study that used 5 gray times 5, there is a higher incidence of things like bowel complications, pelvic insufficiency fractures, but those were trials that were comparing radiotherapy versus no radiotherapy. So I think that the long-term toxicity still sort of remains to be seen.
Great, thank you. Here's a question for Dr. Chang. Can surgery be omitted in favor of definitive chemoradiation for resectable esophageal cancer?
Yeah, also a very frequently asked question. I used to think so. I mean, you see the high response, pathologic complete response rates, nearly 50% with the cross regimen and possibly with higher doses that could be higher. And I was for it in general, but I will say that there was this Korean trial that was presented, not published that I've seen, but presented a few years ago at ASCO, where they randomized patients with clinical complete response to observation versus surgery. And it was a very, very small trial. They wanted to enroll, I think probably over 100, but only wound up enrolling about maybe 19 patients. But even among those with like 9 per arm, there was about a 40% local recurrence rate still in the patients, like 4 out of the 9 patients essentially who were observed recurred locally. So that, super preliminary, very small study, but it was enough for me to kind of open my eyes where if a patient was resectable and in good health, I would still recommend trimodality therapy for those patients.
Great. Here's a question about the use of SBRT for pancreatic cancer. I think both of you can field that question. And they also wanted any specific tips in identifying the duodenum.
Is the specific question about how to do it or when?
Well, whether what to do and then how to do it.
I see. That's a big question. And that's usually, I have.
That's like a topic. That's like an hour long topic.
I have a talk on that actually, but I couldn't fit that in the refresher course. But I'll speak very generally about it. It is something that has been added, part of NCCN. It is a kind of a acceptable standard of care. I think anything that can offer dose escalation is, a time to, is a good opportunity to use it. There are a number of ways that can be done. I think the biggest keys, the biggest principles are that you need to be able to address respiratory motion. And that can be done a number of ways. Our preferred technique at Stanford is to use implanted fiducials. We use respiratory gating on N exhalation in terms of how we identify the duodenum. I honestly don't use anything special anymore. We used to have people drink small amounts of fluid to be able to help, like water, usually negative contrast, so you can kind of see the hypodense liquid in there. Nowadays, I mean, I just think when you do it enough times, you generally can identify and separate the duodenum from the rest of the anatomy. That I usually try to keep them on NP stomachs for treatment and on simulation. So I don't do anything special to try to identify the duodenum.
I'll just add that early on, we started using small bowel contrast because we weren't so sure that we could see the duodenum quite as well. So we would use small bowel contrast at the time of simulation that we just sort of time so that we can see the duodenum. However, during treatment, we would use 12 ounces of water, which has been documented in some of the trials, particularly the multi-institutional trial that was published in Cancer. And so thereafter, though, we then started moving to water. The one benefit, I think, of simulating and treating a patient with water is that if you do have a tumor that's close to the duodenum, it does move that lateral wall away somewhat to just create some space. The only other thing that I would echo that Dan had said is I think fiducial-based SBRT, particularly if you're using 5 fractions, is important. But I think ablative radiotherapy can be given a number of ways. It doesn't have to be 5 fractions. It can be 15 fractions. It can be 25 fractions with dose escalation. So there's a lot of ways to give radiotherapy that may not necessarily fall within the context of 5-fraction SBRT.
I would agree.
Great, thank you. For Dr. Palta, what is the boost dose you use for the lateral pelvic nodes that are greater than 7 millimeters? Is it 60 gray or some other dose?
Yeah, I have to say, so far, every time we've brought it up in tumor board, our surgeons have said they're gonna just go out and resect them because it's becoming a very hot topic. I think that once that paper was published, people started to note this much more often. It became a topic of conversation in our tumor board discussions, and it actually worked its way into our radiology reports so that there is a separate line on our radiology report that comments on size and concern of lateral pelvic nodes. So to date, we actually have not necessarily boosted people because our surgeons have said they would go resect those nodes. So we've done a typical neoadjuvant treatment. However, that being said, if they were not going to resect the nodes, I mean, depending on the location and depending on what the DVH looked like, yeah, I would try to get them somewhere in the neighborhood of 55, 60 gray, if you could, a more definitive dose.
Great. There's a question about a cervical esophageal squamous cell carcinoma, T2N0, close to the larynx. What dose would you use? Dr. Chang?
Okay, I was going to let Manisha go first, but
or either one of you.
Yeah, no. It's a very common question that comes up, and I would love to tell you this is purely opinion-based because you will get many different opinions, but I lean towards treating it more head and neck style, so higher doses. I usually try to take it to 66 gray with concurrent chemo. If you want to ask me what chemo to give, I think that the cisplatin-5-FU is probably what we've been most commonly using, aligned more with like head and neck style chemo radiation. But I mean, carbotaxol we've also been doing as well, and I think that would be a reasonable option. But we usually will take dose up to about at least 60 gray up to 66 gray.
Yeah, so we do the exact opposite. So we always treat with carbotaxol and always use more GI rather than head and neck doses. So typically we're using 50, 40, and generally no higher than 54 gray. That being said, it's a rare bird. So I would have to say that we're never gonna have any robust data to help guide treatment there. I think we're gonna mainly be guided by retrospective and large database reviews about what is the appropriate dose. But there definitely seems to be institutional variations.
All right, so a little different topic, but maybe one that we're being asked to consider is, what is the optimal management for an isolated periodic nodal recurrence from a previously resected colon cancer in the absence of surgery?
Shall I go, Dan, or you?
Either one of you.
I should go first.
Okay. So I think the most important, I saw that question. I love that question. I like oligometastatic disease as a disease entity. For me, I think one of the critical things is what is the disease-free interval? Is it, 2 years? Is it 10 years? Is it 6 months? I think that really helps to guide how I think about the patient and I think about the biology of the patient. If it were a shorter disease-free interval, and I'll say arbitrarily, probably like 2 years or less, I'd be more inclined for that patient to get systemic therapy first before thinking about a consolidative dose of radiotherapy or a definitive dose. If it's been a very long disease-free interval, or say the patient has toxicity or has a relative contraindication or refuses systemic therapy, I have radiated a number of these people. My go-to fractionation is doing it 50 gray in 10 fractions. I find that that has been used, I think, very often in the lung cancer world. It is the fractionation that's used in a number of ongoing randomized studies that are looking at oligometastatic disease. And a lot of that early data came from University of Rochester. And so there's a good amount of experience using that fractionation. The other thing that I think is key is when it's a periaortic node. My bias is that different from a MET in the lung or a MET in the liver, where I'm just treating the target itself, for a periaortic node, I tend to treat the periaortic space with an elective dose, typically 30 gray in 10 fractions, while doing an SIB to boost the involved node 5 gray times 10. And I find often in the periaortic space, you're typically underdosing a little bit because of things like the duodenum, if you're higher up, or the bowel.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with all of that. I mean, usually it'll come out in hopefully some sort of tumor board discussion about whether the treatment should involve chemotherapy or local therapy immediately, but usually that comes out in the discussion. Certainly if a medical oncologist wanted to give chemotherapy, I wouldn't object to that. And it's usually when the time comes for local therapy and they're not surgical, then of course, stereotactic or some sort of ablative radiotherapy, I would agree, just like with Manisha. I usually try to keep it within the SBRT, fractionation course if I can. If it's obviously far away from bowel and those types of things, I would try to get a dose up to maybe, if I could, I would try to get it maybe 48 to 54 gray in 3 fractions, just because, the local failure data, at least in lung in a liver metastases, is generally higher than we'd like. I usually cannot get to that dose fractionation, so it usually is 5 fractions, anywhere between. I try to get about 45 and 5, but if I can get to 50 and 5, that would be something that, probably the most that we could do.
And then when you do that, do you do an eval structure so that the bowel is taken out of that high dose volume with a PRV?
I do a 2 millimeter PRV. So I take all of my bowel, stomach, duodenum, sort of like I would for pancreas cancer. Mm-hmm. I expand that by 2 millimeters and I use that as a PRV. So I actually have the dosimetrist plan off the PRV.
Yeah, we have not, mainly because for dosimetric reasons. I usually, if I'm worried about it, my dose is probably dropping down to 40 gray anyway, or something kind of more conservative. And I guess the other thing I was thinking as we were talking is I also agree with Manisha about, periaortic nodes would make me worry that there are other ones that are hiding. And so I've been more liberal with using like a 25 and 5 type of elective nodal simultaneous boost type dose painted approach. So as far as the exact amount of periaortic nodes I would treat, it would depend on the number and the distribution. But I would also agree with kind of covering sort of an elective area beyond just the gross node.
Yeah, and I think the key distinction there is it's nodal basins rather than just like a visceral MET. And I think that's what guides this idea of an elective volume.
Right.
So here's a good question. How do you manage a rectal cancer patient with indications for post-op radiation after undergoing a surgery with a coloanal anastomosis? So a rare post-op.
Well, fortunately, that doesn't happen often, which is good. I think if you've got, obviously, these are the cases that get reviewed in tumor board to ensure that patients should be receiving adjuvant therapy, that they have pathologic features that suggest we should be treating them. If the patient, you know, we've now largely moved to a TNT approach, so I have to say that this doesn't happen all that much. The few times that I have seen it happen tend to be in patients who have an inflammatory bowel disease, and it's sort of an incidentally found cancer. In those situations, we have treated them post-op like we typically would treat them if they were pre-op. I mean, I do reduce the dose slightly. So in the post-op setting, I don't necessarily treat to 50-40. I usually treat to 45 gray. As I mentioned, oftentimes these are patients that have ulcerative colitis or some sort of inflammatory bowel disease. I usually will try to use IMRT in those situations to try to stay off of the small bowel as much as possible to mitigate toxicity. But those cases are challenging, and generally those patients have a lot more toxicity, I find. Dan, would you do anything differently?
Yeah, no, I'm going to agree with everything you're saying. It's, you know, they'd have to have hopefully very clear and firm indications for postoperative radiotherapy. So my threshold to treat would be a little bit higher. I agree, you know, IMRT, you're probably, if it's really low, you might, depending on if the inguinal nodes need to be treated, but, you know, you probably, whatever you can do to try to minimize the dose there. But, and I often find it's very hard to get sort of like the traditional post-op doses are going to be something higher than 50.4, like 55 or something like that. But I've been finding myself having a harder time getting to those doses because you have such, you know, you have a large amount of small bowel floating deep down in that pelvis. So I've had a hard time getting to those types of doses. 50 gray might be the most I could do. And, you know, probably just do the best we can.
Here's an interesting question. I think relative to use of a vaginal obturator in women in treatment of rectal and anal carcinoma. Do you do this in your practices? And if so, what is the setup and treatment approach?
So for me, there were a couple publications that came out looking at this, and it seemed like a really good idea. I then went to go implement it, and it went very badly from my personal experience, meaning that it wasn't so much of an issue the first few weeks of treatment, but generally as the patients get to week 3, week 4, week 5, the idea of putting a vaginal dilator in was a challenge. And so I have now gotten into the habit of discussing it with patients. And there are certain patients that are very inclined to do everything possible to ensure or mitigate late toxicity. So I used to try to do it routinely, and I found it to be quite challenging as you got towards the end of treatment. And so now I talk with patients about it. And if a patient is motivated to do that, then we'll use it at the time of simulation. And similarly, we would just simulate everything at simulation should be the same as what you're intending for treatment. So we'd continue to use it through treatment. I have had a couple people who then couldn't tolerate it anymore. And so then we've had to re-simulate them, but kind of on a case by case basis.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I haven't implemented myself just yet. We are generally pretty aggressive with, you know, post radiation dilator therapy to try to prevent the stenosis. So it hasn't been a big problem post-operative, you know, post-treatment vaginal stenosis, which we hopefully attribute to, you know, to the post-treatment therapy. So we haven't yet felt the need, or actually felt compelled to do it quite yet.
Yeah. The other thing that I'll add is the couple patients that I've had who've had significant issues related to radiotherapy, that's a really great opportunity to engage physical therapy. So there are dedicated pelvic physical therapists whose love and job is to assist with this. And I have found every patient who's actually committed to doing pelvic physical therapy for bowel symptoms, bladder symptoms, or vaginal related issues has had a benefit.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful resource, both for GI and GYN patients.
Yep.
I don't know if the two of you see other questions that you'd like to be sure we answer before we wrap up soon. There's quite a few that have come in, some about very advanced disease and esophageal cancer and extrahepatic cholangio.
I don't know if I'm seeing all of them. I do see one. I guess someone got confused by my talk, so I feel to respond to it. It says, I thought your takeaway was esophagus was chemo radiation. Then I commented that I prefer trimodality. So I apologize. I didn't mean for that to be sort of the takeaway message. It was mainly, I thought my takeaway message was mainly trimodality therapy as per Cross, because that was sort of the opening topic. It was more in the setting of obviously unresectable disease. And I believe the topic was mostly about the issue of dose escalation and how now that with a number of trials that have shown, that have sort of upheld the initial, you know, Minsky or intergroup trial of no benefit of dose escalation, that, you know, chemo radiation to 50.4 gray was our standard of care. So those were sort of my main two takeaways from the esophageal portion. I didn't mean to confuse anybody.
Yeah, the only question I see, there's lots of questions, but the one that I think maybe that would be worth just addressing a little further is kind of a regimen or what would be the typical follow-up for non-operative patients. And so our institution, we follow a typical guideline that's outlined by the Memorial Sloan Kettering Group. So we're doing MRIs in patients, everything's done at 3 months. MRIs, endoscopy, DRE, and then for systemic staging, we're also still doing a CT of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis.
There are going to be some ASTRO guidelines coming out soon about how to manage the surveillance for non-operative. So stay tuned.
Wonderful. I want to thank both of you for two great lectures and for all of the expertise that you've shared with us. Thank you so much. And thanks to our audience.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And our wonderful ASTRO staff for making this possible. Thank you. Yes.
Kudos to the ASTRO staff.
Yep. Agreed. Take care.
Great. Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.